The furlough scheme is propping up the labor market, for now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year, and that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
Italy's petrol station operators have been staging a strike since Monday to demand the Italian government being included among the recipients of support measures to mitigate the nefarious impact of the anti-COVID restrictions. It is the latest in a string of petrol station strikes over market conditions and aid measures during the pandemic emergency. In late November, another three-day strike had been called by sector unions and organizations and staged on the country's motorways.
Petrol retailers' associations complained that gas stations suffered losses amounting to 90% of their revenues on Italy's motorways and about 60% of their income in urban areas during the lockdown. They say it is no longer possible to meet overheads and fixed costs in the current situation.
Small and very small petrol station operators have been excluded from receiving aid payments from the government because all petrol stations remained open during the lockdown. Considering the cancellation of sales due to COVID and restrictions, we are at risk of no longer being able to guarantee the opening of stations with continuity and regularity.
Last month, the Italian government issued a package of aid for the businesses and families most affected by the new anti-COVID restrictions. As many as 211,000 companies have received support funds totaling over 960 million euros.
There's no doubt that support measures to businesses and families have helped a bit. Having said that, the situation remains critical for many, unfortunately.
New talks between the government and retail groups are likely to be held in the coming days. Petrol station operators are slated to end their strike on Thursday. Max Civili, Rome.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that the EU is far too dependent on the United States dollar, and there is a serious lack of political will when it comes to negating the effects of US sanctions.
The recent American economic sanctions against Russia, Iran and Cuba, especially the extraterritorial effects, should be responded from our side. We need an efficient instrument to counteract these illegal sanctions.
Big firms such as Airbus, Peugeot and Citroen want to do business with countries like Iran, but are being told by the Trump administration that if they do, they will not be able to trade with the United States.
In relation to Iran, the Commission is supportive of the instrument in support of trade exchanges, INSTEX, an initiative of three countries initially, Germany, France and the United Kingdom, and more recently joined by Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland and Sweden.
However, many lawmakers say that EU instruments designed to bypass US sanctions, such as the aforementioned INSTEX, and also the so-called blocking statute, are dysfunctional.
Some analysts argue that European Union foreign policy has been very negatively influenced in recent years by Washington, and that ultimately it is ordinary, hard-working EU citizens who are paying the price for that.
This is because millions of additional jobs could be created if the EU more effectively counteracted US sanctions. Countries like Iran, Russia and Cuba represent huge markets.
It does not only affect EU businesses, but also puts into question the political independence and ultimately the sovereignty of the EU and its member states.
Apparently, hypocrisy is rife. For example, the EU and US shy away from imposing sanctions on Israel and Saudi Arabia, despite the atrocities these regimes commit against civilians in Palestine and Yemen.
It's a fight for global domination of the West, led by the United States of America, but unfortunately, in this fight, they stamp over the very same rules they proclaimed they are struggling for.
And he has lost on the merits.
EU lawmakers have expressed hope that the Joe Biden administration will be less aggressive with respect to sanctions. However, they are calling on the EU to quickly develop policies to try and deliver strategic autonomy for the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israel's municipality in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has approved the building of 8,300 new settler units. According to Israeli media, the settler units are set to be constructed for residential, industrial, and commercial purposes. The new settler units will be built on lands from Beit Safafa, Malha, and Al-Baqa villages in Al-Quds, and all the way to Al-Walaj village, northwest of Beit Lahem in the occupied West Bank. Experts say the construction is scheduled to begin by 2021 and work will continue until 2040.
It's a long-term colonial project that goes until to 2040. This is located mainly on the both sides of the Green Line from the south of the Jerusalem, an area called Tel Aviv. It's taking what has been left from Beit Safafa village, Palestinian village there, and to connect also the settlements, the blocks of the settlements with the south of Jerusalem, what we call the Greater Jewish Jerusalem, that reach up to Gush Etzion, about 40 kilometers south of Jerusalem.
In addition to the new settlement units, Israel revealed earlier new projects, including building dozens of roads between settlements through a master plan, the first of its kind in years, to establish a transportation network in the settlements. The Palestinian National Bureau for Defending Land and Resisting Settlements accused Israel of expanding the settlements in the West Bank by constructing new roads. They say the move is a clear indication that Israel carries on with its plan to annex large parts of the occupied West Bank.
It's part of a larger plan of colonization. The Israeli occupation is racing against time to change the demography of the region. It is seeking to achieve its project, known as Greater Jerusalem, by 2040. Israel plans to establish a state for settlers inside the Palestinian state.
Observers say through settlement expansion, Israel is looking to ensure that within the next decade, 1 million Jewish settlers will live in the occupied West Bank. Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Palestinians say all indications prove that Israel is racing against time to build a new settlement before the outgoing U.S. administration leaves office. The Palestinian Authority has warned that settlement activity has grave consequences in the occupied West Bank and will definitely lead to more Palestinian land grab by the Israeli regime to facilitate the annexation of the occupied territories. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52-48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. After it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with four Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi,
kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
The debate.
Welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. The Syrian envoy to the United Nations has criticized the Security Council being used as a tool to serve Western countries' political agenda. Bashar al-Jafari slammed what it called the Council's inaction against occupation of Syrian territory. He called Washington and Ankara as occupiers of northern Syria. The Iranian UN envoy has also warned of Washington's secret agenda in Syria, urging U.S. forces to evacuate. He also condemned the U.S. unilateral sanctions on Damascus. Now, let's go to Syria. Our correspondent, Mohammed Ali, is there for us. Let's see what he has for us. Mohammed, over to you.
Yes, Syria's permanent representative at the United Nations, Dr. Bashar al-Jafari, said in his latest word before the UN Security Council, he actually focused that word on what he described as the UN Security Council's failure for decades in addressing many issues that threaten international peace and security in the region and in the world, mainly the Israeli occupation of Arab lands in Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon, the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, and NATO's destruction of Libya. Now, regarding Syria, al-Jafari said that after 10 years of the UN Security Council's intervention in discussing the situation in Syria, he said, and I quote, "We still see U.S. occupation in northeastern Syria, U.S. support to terrorist groups and separatist militias, meaning the so-called SDF, as well as U.S. occupation of Al-Tanf area and Al-Rukban camp, in addition to the U.S. Support to Daesh and the so-called Maghawir al-Thawra terrorist groups." He also noted that there is still Turkish occupation in areas northwestern Syria, and that whereas Turkey there supports and recruits mercenaries, using them, as he described, in the market of international wars. He also said that we still witness Turkey's war crimes against Syrians, such as killings, displacement, looting, and depriving Syrians of drinking water. Al-Jafari also stressed that, in addition to all that, in southern Syria, we also continue to see the Israeli occupation. Al-Jafari made it clear that Western member states of the UN Security Council did not do anything to enable that council to fulfill its commitments and tasks to end the U.S., Israeli, and Turkish occupation of Syrian lands, and that all those Western states did was that they only fueled the crisis in Syria, prolonged it, and further complicated it, turning the council into a tool in service of their political agendas.
All right, thank you for that, Mohammed Ali, correspondent in Damascus, Syria. Let me invite to author and activist with International Action Center, Sarah Flounders from New York. Good to have you with us, ma'am. The United States and Turkey have not been invited by the Damascus government to go to Syria. And Damascus regards their presence as illegal in occupation. What's the U.S. doing there?
Well, the U.S. from the very beginning has been attempting a regime change operation, in other words, a completely illegal pull down of the Syrian elected government and a destruction of Syria. They have really sought, since 2003, there have been U.S. sanctions on Syria, and beginning now, it's going into the 10th year, U.S. intervention through mercenary forces, through bombings, through troops of occupation, every effort to overturn the government of Syria. And it is a criminal operation, every single aspect of it.
Okay, now from London, I'm also joined by Secretary General of the Next Century Foundation, William Morris. William, the Pentagon says that U.S. forces are protecting the fields and facilities from possible Daesh attacks, ignoring what President Trump said a bit before that, that Washington was seeking economic interest in controlling Syrian oil fields. Let's have your take.
Well, the U.S. is scarcely relevant with regard to Syria now, is it? I mean, it has very little role. The problem more is to do with, I suppose, its main role is imposing sanctions. Its troops are down to minimum. They're over by the Iraq border. The real worry is Turkey and Turkey's incursions. Turkey is the big beast as far as Syria is concerned. It's causing a lot of problems, and particular problems for the people of northern Syria. Of course, Idlib is miserable. That whole area is miserable and living in misery. And because there is this problem between Turkey, Syria, and the Islamist fighters that are there, many of whom are, of course, backed by Turkey and supported by Turkey. There are big problems within northern Syria, and I presume that there will be a major onslaught by the Syrian government to try and clean up Idlib before the presidential elections next. Well, they're delayed, I think, from May to June. But anyway, next June, that's when they're held. Meanwhile, the fiasco of the negotiations in Geneva over a putative constitution rumble on, with everybody spiking it. It really is a joke, the UN-sponsored negotiations in Geneva. The Syrian government delays everything as best it can, and meanwhile, the rump members of the opposition in Geneva that are representing the Syrian opposition, and they scarcely represent anything, are too busy drinking booze and caviar, eating caviar and living it up, and they run, the discussions go on and on and on, and they have another round and another round. There'll be another round. They'll get nowhere, and they'll be irrelevant. So that's a particular joke. But no, in many ways, Syria is much stabler. The main part of Syria, if you discount the extreme north, is stable and is doing quite well. You have these ridiculous Israeli air raids, which are just Israel trying to score points while Trump is still president, because they realize they'll have to be a little quieter, perhaps, with the incoming U.S. president, who may not have the same, may not give them the same carte blanche as Trump did. But no, things in Syria, if you discount the north and if you discount these stupid, pointless air raids there was one recently just south of Damascus on allegedly on some Iranian troops, allegedly in response to an attempt to break through the border fence on the Golan. I mean, if there was an attempt to break through the border fence by some Golanis, they get so many, they have such a miserable time, they're divided by that border fence, aren't they? So they have that, yeah, sadness, and I'm sure there might have been some incident, but it's kind of irrelevant. Okay. It's just an excuse. Sorry, enough. But that's my take on the situation at present.
Okay. Now, of course, we're discussing the northern part of Syria, where the U.S. and Turkish forces are present. Sarah, President Trump said in October last year that practically, I'm quoting him, that practically we are out of Syria. The troops are there to, quote, secure the oil. Is that what they're doing? We have reports of, you know, just last week, 30 tankers, you know, carrying crude oil to Iraq, U.S. actually forces. So are U.S. forces guarding the Syrian crude, as President Trump is claiming, or plundering the Syrian resources?
Well, from the very beginning, this has been about plundering the Syrian resources. And could they completely overturn, collapse the government, set up their own government? That was the aim. That aim did not succeed because the level of Syrian resistance on every measure has just been incredible. 10 years of the most difficult, difficult resistance and fighting tens of thousands of U.S. and Turkish and Saudi armed mercenaries, militias. It's really been an incredible U.S. bombing, supposedly against Daesh ISIS forces, but really to completely destroy as much as they could of Syrian infrastructure. From the beginning, U.S. policy has been how much damage can they do and how much can they lay hold of in a complete act of piracy. Now, Trump was right up front in saying that U.S. interest is in the oil fields. Mm-hmm. U.S. interest has never been in the people of Syria, never been, of course, in human rights or democracy. It's been in oil and in the control. It's not that Syria wasn't making the oil available on world markets. It's that the U.S. wants to control the market and actually break up also not only Syria, but the entire region. And that is the, in every sense, the United States has played a role in how to destabilize not only Syria, but continue the occupation of Palestine, do as much damage and disorganization as they possibly can in Lebanon, continue to threaten Iran. This is U.S. policy, continue the occupation in Iraq, in northern Iraq. So the troops have been moved back and forth, in and out, along with thousands and tens of thousands of contractors and mercenaries. Every part of it, and with NATO support, Turkey is a member of NATO for 70 years and still acts with a certain level of coordination, although they have their own interests and aims in this, also completely criminal, piracy and looting. So I think it's important to really salute the level of Syrian resistance by the government, by the people, by an organized, cohesive force that continued to feed the population of Syria, that continued to provide medical relief. In my travels to Syria, I was really amazed, impressed by the level of cohesion, even in wartime, that continued in Syria. Mm-hmm. And it's now, Syria is rebuilding in whole parts of Syria, but it's made more difficult because the sanctions continue to bite deep. They stop any country from just providing basic rebuilding material. And that's another crime. We have to acknowledge that as much damage as any other country is doing, the greatest damage comes from U.S. power and coordination to try to damage Syria and continue to extract a heavy price. Now, we've got a demand of this new administration. They say they're different. They got to prove it. They got to prove it to the people of the world, to the people of Syria, and right here to the people in the U.S.
Right.
If they're different, they got to act different.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, William, Sarah talked about what the U.S. is doing in northern Syria. What about Turkey now? What's Ankara's agenda behind maintaining military presence in northern Syria?
Well, I'll just take issue with Sarah slightly. I mean, I'm sure we agree with regard to Turkey. With regard to the United States of America, I mean, doesn't want Syria's assets. Okay, Trump may come out with lines like that, but they are so piffling. They're so small. The oil resources you're talking about are so trivial, that they are really irrelevant to a world in which oil is, which is becoming fast less oil dependent. And Syria still has to depend on Iranian subsidies, and it's not, this is really not what America's policy is about. America's policy was about destabilizing Bashar al-Assad, but I don't think anybody in the world really cares that much about Syrian oil. If you're talking, the Kurds care a lot about it, and they are trying to export a little, and they've got a U.S. company buying it. And yes, the U.S., the piffling levels of troops that are left by the U.S., and the U.S. has really abandoned the Syrian Kurds and abandoned northern Syria. And the Syrian Kurds were helping them in the fight against Daesh. They left them to the to become victims of Turkey. And Turkey has been the brute on the block and has been quite ruthless in regard to, yes, to, in regard to the Syrian Kurds. So the Syrian Kurds are now seeking a kind of accommodation with Bashar al-Assad's government, and very eagerly doing so, and are being well received, and there are talks in place, and I'm sure the oil issue will be resolved between the Syrian Kurds and Bashar al-Assad's government. But the but as regards Turkey, Turkey's behavior is beyond, I mean, it is so disturbing. And of course, it's partly a Turkish fear. It's based on fear, this kind of, well, partly fear, fear of their own Kurdish minority. And so they don't want to see a successful Kurdish area of northern Syria, because it means that their own Kurdish minority will turn around and say, what about us? And they are repressed. I mean, you many of them live under curfew. They have a very difficult time in Turkish, the Kurdish areas of Turkey. So we really have a lot to question Erdogan of Turkey about, and he is becoming an adventurous, not just in Syria, but in Libya too, and all over the place.
He's Mediterranean.
Helps him distract his own population from their own troubles, mm-hmm. if he can divert them with foreign adventures. And in a sense, that's the other reason for Turkey's involvement in northern Syria. It distracts his local population from their own troubles at home, and mm-hmm. they have a few.
Okay. Now, Sarah, do you share the Syrian UN envoy's argument? He says that the UN Security Council has turned into a tool to serve the political agenda of a number of Western states.
Well, I don't know if it's been turned into, or it has always been, a tool of U.S. and EU Western interests. And it has functioned both through its resolutions, through its vetoes, through its UN-imposed sanctions, in every single way has functioned against the interests of the people of the world, and again against the interests of peace. And when the U.S. Policymakers are able to use the U.N. Security Council, they do so. And when they want to ignore it because they can't get a vote through, they ignore it. But certainly in all of this, the U.N. Security Council has operated with complete connivance from both Washington and from the EU. That is a real problem, and it's very important that Bashar al-Jafari raises this, because he is the Syrian representative to the UN, so he speaks with great authority, knowing again and again the efforts of Syria to make their case to the UN Security Council, and how it there's been a deaf ear turned consciously, mm-hmm. consciously. Also, just to say with the to the other speaker, I do agree that this is not just a war for oil, that Syria's oil is not of any great amount. And it is primarily a war to destabilize and to try to assert U.S. dominance in the entire region. Mm-hmm. It's because Syria also defended the Palestinian people and defended the interests of the people of Syria, that Syria was targeted from the very beginning. And so we want to, every war, every U.S. war is not for oil. The U.S. has blockaded and Cuba for years. Cuba has no oil and no great resources, but is determined to have its own independent policy and develop the country in the interests of the Cuban people. Now, this is also true in Syria. That determination to build a multinational, multi-religious, a mosaic of all the people of Syria for the benefit of the Syrian people and to use the resources for that. Syria accomplished great things. They had the highest educational and health standards in the entire region before this war. And this war has literally left, I think, a quarter of the population uprooted as both migrants internally and outside of Syria. That is a horrendous toll. And it's a toll that is how to create havoc. Every single U.S. war is never about construction. It's always about destruction.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes left. So I got one question for both of you. William, you talked about Israeli aggression against Syrian Golan Heights. Tell us what Israel is doing there in northern Syria. In 1 minute, please.
It's just taking advantage of the last moments of a Trump presidency. They are slightly nervous about the incoming president-elect, Biden, Joe Biden. And of course, he's very pro-Israeli. He describes himself as pro-Israel and pro-Israel's interests, but he's a different kind of character from Donald Trump, who was almost you could regard him as Israel's man in Washington. Donald Trump has been very extraordinary. Now Biden's not going to take back the embassy from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv or do anything of that kind. He is very pro-Israel, but he isn't as blanket an actor as Trump has been.
Okay.
And so Israel's taking this advantage of this moment to score a few points while it can.
Right. Okay. Sarah, go ahead, please.
Well, I think Golan has been occupied now, more than 50 years. Through Democratic and Republican administrations, and the U.S. funding, arming in astronomical ways the Israeli occupation of Palestine, of Golan, both. So will there be any change with the Biden administration? There will be a change in the conduct. That does not mean in the policy. Biden will have a different face than the Trump administration. That's true.
Right.
And important, Trump was defeated. That's true. But it's up to the population here and around the world to demand different of an administration.
Okay, thank you so much for your contribution and insight. We had Secretary General of the Next Century Foundation, William Morris from London, and author, activist, and with the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders, who joined us from New York.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 15 of Surah Jathiyah.
من عمل صالحا فلنفسه ومن أساء فعليها ثم إلى ربكم ترجعون.
Whoever acts righteously, it is for his own soul, and whoever does evil, it is to its own detriment. Then you will be brought back to your Lord. Remember, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said God has made the entire universe subservient to mankind so that we use it in a proper manner and express gratitude to Him through contemplation on these great bounties, instead of being thankless or misusing these favors to bring destruction upon others and eventually upon our own selves. Thus, divine punishment or reward is in accordance with one's own deeds. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that the fruits of any deed, whether sweet or bitter, will determine the eventual fate of the doer on the day of judgment. In other words, divine reward or punishment is just and in accordance with a person's good or evil deeds. At times, those who fail to understand divine wisdom ask whether God Almighty gains or loses anything as a result of the obedience or disobedience of any person. The answer is obvious. A teacher always tells the students to listen attentively to lessons and study well in order to pass, and that too with destination marks. But if some of the students were to fail because of their scant regard to the lessons taught by the teacher and refusal to do homework, their failure will not harm sympathetic teacher at all. Thus, if we strive towards perfection through our good deeds, by avoiding the pitfalls, we will certainly be rewarded by the All-Merciful Lord. As for those who indulge in sins and unbelief to end up in everlasting damnation, the fault is their own, and they have deprived themselves of divine mercy. This ayah teaches us that, number one, the All-Merciful Lord is just and rewards the virtuous for their good deeds and is ready to forgive those who sincerely repent and turn to Him for forgiveness in the transient life of the mortal world, while those who didn't and died in the state of unbelief and sins will be punished in accordance with the degree of their evil deeds. And number two, the Almighty Creator is too glorious to either benefit or be harmed by our good or evil deeds. Now let us listen to ayahs 16 and 17 of the same surah.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ الْكِتَابَ وَالْحُكْمَ وَالنُّبُوَّةَ وَرَزَقْنَاهُمْ مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَفَضَّلْنَاهُمْ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ وَآتَيْنَاهُمْ بينات من الأمر فما اختلفوا إلا من بعد ما جاءهم العلم بغيا بينهم إن ربك يقضي بينهم يوم القيامة فيما كانوا فيه يختلفون.
Certainly we gave the children of Israel the book, judgment, and prophethood, and we provided them with all the good things, and we gave them an advantage over all the nations, and we gave them manifest precepts. But they did not differ except after knowledge had come to them, out of envy among themselves. Indeed, your Lord will judge between them on the day of resurrection concerning that about which they used to differ. These ayahs refer to the ancient Israelites who were descended from the 12 sons of Prophet Jacob, who was also called Israel. Prophets were raised amongst them, and heavenly scriptures revealed for their guidance as part of the mercy shown to them by God Almighty in spite of their disobedience, since they were at least monotheist compared to nations immersed in idol worship. Yet they failed to benefit from the divine favors. As a result of their wrongdoing, ingratitude, and indulgence in sins, their exalted station turned into humility and damnation. It is reported that over 1,000 prophets were appointed for their guidance between the missions of prophets Moses and Jesus, peace upon them, but instead of heeding the words of God, they conspired against the prophets, persecuted them, and killed many of them. The worst form of unbelief is to differ in matters of truth when God Almighty had granted knowledge and manifest precepts, as Ayah 17 points out. Among other things, these evident proofs refer to the coming of the last and greatest prophets amongst the Ishmaelite Arabs with the universal message of Islam, as mentioned clearly in the Torah and other scriptures. This is a clear reference to the mission of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Yet the Israelites, despite enjoying such favors, became envious, disobeyed God, and deliberately ignored the message of the Prophet of Islam by resorting to illogical and irrational arguments, for which God will judge between them on the day of resurrection and mete out the punishment they deserve. These ayahs also serve as a warning to the Muslims against indulging in the same thankless attitude towards divine favors as the Israelites did, and refusal out of jealousy to recognize the means of guidance that the Prophet had left behind in the form of the noble Quran and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, the source of all blessings, whether material or spiritual, is God, and we should use them in the proper manner for our own salvation. Number two, religious teachings and state rule do not contradict each other, and as a matter of fact, politics ought to be based on religious principles, unlike the Western Zionist propaganda of separation between religion and state. Number three, God has sealed his argument through clear proofs that enable us to recognize and understand the manifest truth of which we will be questioned on the day of judgment. And number four, awareness and recognition are not enough for salvation, since there are many who recognize the truth but stir up sedition and discord in the society out of envy and disobedience of God, as the Israelites did. Here are ayahs 18, 19, and 20 of Surah Jathiyah.
ثم جعلناك على شريعة من الأمر فاتبعها ولا تتبع أهواء الذين لا يعلمون. إنهم لن يغنوا عنك من الله شيئا وإن الظالمين بعضهم أولياء بعض والله ولي المتقين هذا بصائر للناس وهدى ورحمة لقوم يوقنون
Then we set you upon a clear course of the law. So follow it, and do not follow the desires of those who do not know. Indeed, they will not avail you in any way against Allah. Indeed, the wrongdoers are allies of one another. But Allah is the guardian of the God-weary. These are eye-openers for mankind, and guidance and mercy for a people who have certitude. Here, the address is to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God placed him on the clear path of divine law. It is the path of piety, which means that whoever is responsible for guiding the people ought to be fully aware of the Prophet's Sharia and diligently adhere to it. The word Sharia is applied to a waterway leading to a river. But in common usage, it denotes the path of prophets, which culminates in the Islamic Sharia, since the Noble Quran is the final heavenly scripture revealed to the last and greatest prophet. Thus, the prophet of Islam upon divine commandment does not take into consideration the desires of the ignorant, since he is vested with the ultimate truth that will remain till the end of the world. To be more precise, God has designated the straight and unwavering path of Islam to which the Prophet firmly adheres and invites mankind to it by rejecting the idea of compromise on the principles of religion with any of the disbelievers, whether it is the Arab polytheists or the Israelites who might attempt to distort faith. As the next ayah says, these deviant elements who are accomplices of each other in the vain bid to prevent the spread of Islam will never succeed, since God, the Omnipotent, is the guardian of the pious. Thus, these disbelievers can neither stop the disasters and afflictions in this world nor can save themselves and their followers from divine wrath on the Day of Judgment. Ayah 20 means to say that piety serves as the basis of insight, while the proper understanding of the Noble Quran acts as the eye-opener, providing insight in all intellectual, ethical, political, social, economic, and family matters. Firstly, the Noble Quran is vision, in the same manner as the eyes of our head makes the seeing of objects and colors possible, the Noble Quran is the eye of the heart through which knowledge finds its way to the heart. Illuminating it and showing the path of deliverance from the shadows of ignorance to the light of knowledge and wisdom. Secondly, the Noble Quran is the guidance toward the path of felicity in the world and salvation in afterlife. Thirdly, the Noble Quran is divine mercy bestowed upon the true believers who diligently follow its injunctions and instructions with certitude. From these ayahs, we learn the following points. Number one, Islam is culmination of the messages preached by the prophets of the past, reaching perfection through the universal mission revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Number two, it is piety that makes a person deserving of divine protection, and one of the characteristics of the pious is their abstaining from the goals and desires of the ignorant and deviated elements. Number three, faith is based on insight and awareness in order to guide others with certitude. And number four, the Noble Quran is the source of insight and knowledge in all ideological, ethical, social, political, and family matters.
the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.